The last case before the court this morning is in the matter of the investigated individual. Appearances for the parties, Stacy Hagee and Talbot Wazorik appear on behalf of appellant Denny Sanford, and Ms. Hagee will be arguing this morning. And for the state of South Dakota, appellee is Paul Sweetland. I understand he'll be arguing for 3 minutes. And then John Arneson, representing the Argus Leader, will be arguing for 6 minutes. And then Jeffrey Beck, representing ProPublica, will be arguing 6 minutes.
Jeff precedes me.
Okay, so who's going to go first?
Paul, Jeff,
John. Got it. Okay. And then, Ms. Hagee, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal at the end. Before we get started with the arguments this morning, I just want to note the court is really pleased this morning to have retired Chief Justice David Gilbertson sitting with us in place of Justice Salter, having recused himself in this case. So thank you, Justice Gilbertson, for sitting with us this morning. We appreciate it. With that, Ms. Hagee, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. The state has ended its investigation into my client as has concluded that no crime was committed. This appeal, however, is focused on the narrow issue of redaction, whether my client, now cleared by the investigation, has a right to inspect the search warrant affidavits for confidential information before they are released to the public. And although this court will hear from them today, the press is not an interested party, and they have no standing to challenge my client's right to inspect those affidavits.
Who does have standing?
I would say my client certainly does, as well as the state here, but the press, as a representative of the general public.
So you're saying only the state has standing to basically contest what your position is?
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, the facts of this case, this case has been before this court before. In late 2019 and early 2020, 5 search warrants were issued in an investigation into my client. The court granted the state's request to seal those search warrant records, as well as ordering that the execution of the search warrants not to be disclosed. However, a reporter illicitly became aware of those search warrants and requested the search warrant documents pursuant to SDCL 23A-35-4.1. That statute prohibits courts from sealing certain search warrant records, but allows them to seal the affidavits in support until an investigation is terminated or until an indictment is filed. After the circuit court proceedings, this court, in its earlier decision, addressed whether the statute violated separation of powers principles and ultimately upheld the constitutionality of Section 4.1. After that ruling, my client, through counsel, was given an opportunity to inspect the unredacted versions of the search warrant records to be released before they were released to the public. Everyone agreed on the redactions, and then the redacted search warrant records in this matter under the prior decision were released to the public. The affidavits, however, remained sealed from everyone, including from my clients. Now, the press, after that had occurred, shortly thereafter requested again the affidavits, but the circuit court denied that request. The Attorney General's office then took the unusual step of filing this notice of completed investigation, informing the court that the investigation into my client was completed and that the state had found no prosecutable offenses against my client. This then, in turn, triggered the 4.1 provision regarding the unsealing of the affidavit. Because at that point, my client has still not had the opportunity to review the affidavits themselves and participate in the redaction process, my client made that request to the circuit court, but the circuit court at this time denied the request. The affidavits do remain sealed pending this appeal, however. Now, to be absolutely clear, My client is not challenging the forthcoming unsealing of these affidavits. Under Section 4.1, a triggering event has occurred when the state filed its notice of completed investigation. However, despite the press's urging, this unsealing is not automatic. It does not occur the instant that that investigation has been completed.
So, Ms. Hagee, assuming, as you have indicated here, that the affidavit's entitled to public release at this point, what's the purpose of redaction? What would you be accomplished for you to be able to review the affidavits before they're released?
So under SDCL 15-15A-13, parties or the person who's the subject of the information have the right to request information, that has to include the documents itself or information within those documents for purposes of redaction. If there's confidential information within it, then a party may request that that be redacted pursuant to that statute. Information is non-public, it's confidential, and that's the mechanism that this court, through its court rules, has set up to keep that information confidential and sealed from the public.
So the court took out what it deemed to be the confidential material. The court said, I'm going to redact it. How is that an abuse of discretion? The court's saying I'm taking out addresses, phone numbers, birth dates, etc. How is that an abuse of discretion by not allowing your client advance opportunity, so to speak, to view the affidavits?
That the court has that right to do that under its own motion in Section 13. It can redact certain information. However, that does not prevent or prohibit my client from also seeking, reviewing the document to see if there's any other additional information that the court did not redact that should remain confidential or should remain redacted from the public's view. Now, the court, in its opinion, seemed to limit its review to only that information listed in 15-15A-8 or other personally identifying information. However, that's not the realm of confidential information that could be kept sealed from the
public. What's to keep the position you're advocating from literally swallowing up 4.1 to where now there is no public access anymore? It's all been redacted.
That's where the court has to view any request to redact under Section 13 and make that determination. Any statute sealing information or continuing to keep information confidential that is contained within the broader contents of the affidavit itself must be subject to being sealed. In that situation, you have a more specific statute controlling and addressing that confidential information.
So, you know, at this stage, it's more the process that you're in front of us on, because without seeing them, you don't even know if there's anything in there that you would request to be redacted, or at least that's the representation that you've made?
Absolutely,
correct?
Your Honor.
So if we just talk about the process, the circuit court here did seem concerned about how this process would look like in this particular case. And so you pointed out, you know, you initially said that the members of the press don't have standing with respect to the privacy rights of your client, but this particular statute is an access statute and allows a request to prohibit public access. It says notice must be provided to all parties in the case, but it also says in the court may order notice to be provided to others with an interest in the matter. Well, clearly we have the press has been expressing an interest in this matter and has been involved in these proceedings throughout, and the rule also requires the court to use the least restrictive means to achieve the purpose of the access rule. And the court was concerned about that. So how would the court then not apply those provisions of the statute and just allow your client access to the affidavit?
So I would say there's two main errors with the way that this court or the circuit court looked at that situation. First, the court indicated that our status in this is as an interested party. But under 15-15A-13, we're not an interested party looking to challenge any motion to seal. We're the actual point of the statute where we can make the request to redact information. We're a party, and we're the topic of the information that is within that. Therefore, we have that right under Section 13 to make that request to redact the information.
Does the statute specifically grant you the right of redaction or just the right to inspect?
The statute grants parties and the individuals that are the subject of the information the right to request I have it right here. The right to request that the information within there be prohibited from public access. So it does not explicitly indicate a right to inspect the document itself, but that is inherent, that is implicit within that right that the legislature has granted us. In order to make a determination of whether there's information in there that shouldn't be provided to the general public, you have to see the document itself. Otherwise, I would ask the court, what would that motion look like? It would have to list every possible piece of confidential information, trade secrets, financial information, but even that wouldn't be enough to allow my client an opportunity to fully present the issue to the court, because then the issue becomes is, well, what type of financial information or trade secrets could be within the document itself? That's certainly something where court staff or even the state itself isn't in a position to know that information. The only person that's in the best position to know that information is my client, who is here today asking for the opportunity to inspect that
document. How do you see this playing out? So let's say the court did give you access to it, and you reviewed it, and you determined there were a number of things that you think your client has the right to request to be redacted. The statute also says the court shall hear any objections from other interested parties to the request to prohibit public access to information in the court record. So would then you be sharing with the other interested parties in this case specifically what you wanted redacted so that there could be an argument before the court? Or how do you see this playing out?
Well, first, I would go back and say as to this specific situation, the second issue with how the court had looked at it was the interested party giving that status to the press here. They're really only, in their words, they're here to represent the general public. Being a representative of the general public does not make you an interested party for purposes of 15A13. That has to mean something more than just allowing the general public an opportunity to come in and challenge all of these. Second, I would, as to your pointed question, I would say it could be very similar to discovery disputes, where one side has noted that information is confidential for various reasons. The other side, which in this situation would be possibly any other interested party that meets that standard, could come in and say, no, we don't think it should be redacted. But they wouldn't necessarily be entitled to see the full document itself, because that would defeat the general purpose.
I'm not sure what standard you're referring to for an interested party.
So an interested party in the context of 15A13 has to be someone with some direct ties to the case, to the situation. It can't just be the general public. Otherwise, what phrase and what would that even mean? Why would the legislature have included that specific right for interested parties to come in? And a court who would be allowed to provide notice to an interested party, well, if a court could provide notice to the general public, how would that work out? A court could pick and choose whoever to provide notice to come in and argue against the motion to seal.
Well, we're not talking here about picking and choosing a particular person or someone from the public to come in. We've had two representatives from the media, an implicated individual that have been involved in this case from day one, really instigated the case. So has there ever been a standing argument issued or made by your client before what seems to be kind of a last minute effort to make that argument?
Your Honor, I would say in the first round of this case, it was not specifically made. I believe there was a footnote in appellant's opening brief questioning the standing of the press to be involved at that point. There, however, you had a situation where documents were sealed from the public's view. So the public's right of access was being affected at that time.
So now you've got a standing issue, and this really ties in directly to what Judge Power wrote in his opinion. He talked about the fact that, hey, if I get into this redaction and let the parties redact this, we may be litigating this case for months longer. We've already litigated this for 2.5 years. I can do the redaction, and it's appropriate for me to do that in this instance and let these affidavits be released. And he's complying with what we said in implicated individual one, which is pretty clear. We said SDCL 23A 35.4.1 permits the circuit court to, quote, seal the contents of an affidavit in support of a search warrant upon a showing of reasonable cause, but only until the investigation is terminated or an indictment or information is filed, end quote. That's a direct quote from what we said in implicated individual one. The court's sitting there, and he's got this request now, what appears to be kind of a last-minute request for a redaction of these affidavits, and he's saying, I'm not going to let this thing go on for another month, 6 months, year, whatever it might be, and we're going to start talking about standing and all kinds of constitutional issues. I'm just going to do the redaction and we're done. And how is that an abuse of discretion?
Your Honor, I would say that it's not a last minute request, because that was the very first time where my client could request the redaction of the information. It could request the opportunity to inspect the document itself. Until that point, it had remained sealed under circuit court order because there was an ongoing investigation. The minute the state filed the notice of terminated investigation, that was the first instance where my client asked for this opportunity to participate in the redaction of the document itself. To require the parties to go and fight about redaction without knowing if or when this document was ever going to be unsealed, or if there was going to be other circumstances involved, would have been a waste of judicial resources and effectively required the parties to go through and give all this notice and go through this process without knowing if the document would ever be unsealed.
And your time is up, Ms. Hagee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sweetland, you may proceed with your initial argument.
May it please the court. Here, the state's interest is in the development and adoption of a privacy standard that does not swallow the rule of public access to records of law enforcement and judicial activity. Here, the intrusion on privacy incident to the search was warranted by a judicial finding of probable cause. So now the question is whether privacy that was subject to lawful intrusion may be reasserted to deny the public access to records of law enforcement and judicial activity just because no indictment was returned, and more particularly, what standard governs such a determination. We have the statutes, of course, and initially appellant asserted that the standard of certain interested individuals should control, but in the state's opinion, that standard does not properly protect the public's interest in keeping a watchful eye on the workings of law enforcement and the judiciary. And perhaps realizing that to be true, appellant's reply brief proposed the Hubbard standard. But the Hubbard standard was formulated to answer an entirely different legal question than this case. Hubbard examined when a judge should unseal documents seized from a third-party non-defendant that were introduced into the record of, but not put to use, of a pretrial suppression hearing. Here we have not a third-party non-defendant, but the subject of the warrant. And here we have not extraneous documents that were not used in a court proceeding, but the very warrant applications that the court relied on in making its probable cause determination.
Mr. Swedlund, wouldn't it be more appropriate if we're going to set some standards that applies to everybody to have this go through either the legislative process of a statute or a formal court rule with public input rather than just issuing an edict and an opinion?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed the first part of your question.
I'm asking how you establish these standards. You're suggesting that we adopt them today, is what I understand. I'm saying, isn't it a better alternative to either go through the legislative process and have a statute clarify what the factors are, or have this court adopt a formal court rule?
I think, actually, Your Honor, I think the statutes are pretty clear as what the standard is. And when we talk about, there's discussion of privacy within the statutes, but then the question becomes, what is the scope of that privacy? And I think courts are capable of coming up with a standard that does that. And the standard that we proposed is the standard from the L.S. Starrett case that was formulated to address the situation like this case. And reduced to its essence, L.S. Starrett extended privacy protections only to the information that was extraneous to the probable cause determination. But information pertinent to the probable cause determination, which forms the basis of judicial action, is public information.
Mr. Sweet, go ahead. You can ask.
How would you respond to Ms. Hagee's comment regarding the difficulty in even crafting a motion for redaction, namely because they don't know what kind of trade secrets or financial information, et cetera, might be contained within the affidavits?
That's what judges do all day long. They're capable of applying standards, and they're capable of looking at a warrant and deciding, you know, what's confidential, what's extraneous, what isn't. We have statutes to guide them. And I think a standard like L.S. Starrett says, let's focus on what went into the probable cause determination. And if it went into the probable cause determination, it's public.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sweetland. Mr. Beck, you're going to argue next.
May it please the court. Counsel. My name is Jeff Beck, and I proudly represent ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative journalism newsroom. In July of 2020, my client went to the clerk of courts in Minnehaha County and requested search warrant documents regarding an investigation of T. Danny Sanford into the distribution and possession of child pornography. Those documents were sealed by Judge Power at the time. Shortly after our request was made, the Argus Leader joined in making that request. The issue went before Judge Power, and when he looked at it, he said, you know, folks, I think I might have made a mistake. Let's come to the table and talk about this. An invite was sent to the implicated individual in that matter, and to Sanford's counsel. The conversation that took place when we talk about that, or those underlying warrants, were not requested at the time. What was looking for were those things that the statute 4.1 specifically, explicitly says are public documents. The warrant itself, the returns, and the inventories. We weren't asking for the underlying affidavits. We were asking based on a clear, unambiguous statute. When Judge Power made his opinion, he said, we agree with you folks. We came before this court. This court said, we agree with you folks that the statute is clear. They gave, or an admonishment was made to Sanford's counsel, you might want to watch out if you continue to appeal this. You're risking making arguments that are without merit. Our position in this case is when Judge Power ruled the first time that the statute was clear, when this court affirmed that the statute was clear, that those documents are public. They're out there. The press has the ability, the public has the ability to get those.
You've got to acknowledge, though, that there is the redaction before. They don't become public instantly when this court ruled. There was still a redaction step that needed to be followed, whether it was done by the judge or some other way, correct?
Correct. The redaction, yeah, under, if you go to 1515A8, there's a redaction that commonly occurs where it talks about Social Security numbers,
yeah,
financial information, and the names of children under certain protected cases. Other than that, that's the general redaction.
The judge here kind of expanded that and included names, phone numbers, things like that. You don't have any issue with that, do you?
Well, I guess I do. And if the document itself is supposed to be public, in here, we're not going to take out a name. We're not going to remove the name of a defendant. So, yes, I would take issue with that, Chief Justice, if they tried to take out the name of the defendant listed in this case. Now, if they tried to take out a Social Security, I have no issue with that. The statute clearly says that Social Security number will be removed from the document. One thing that we have to look at, too, is the rule that was attempted to be argued under the 15-15-13, this court already addressed that. And when it talked about the fact that that's a general rule, the more specific rule is the 4.1 rule. And the 4.1 specifically addresses search warrants and the underlying affidavit and explicitly says, and this court affirmed that they become public when that investigation is over. In May of 2022, the South Dakota Attorney General's office said, our investigation is over.
Didn't the ruling, though, in that case have some language that said, you know, notwithstanding the ability to redact, or it did refer to redaction in some respect? And we didn't have this particular argument in front of us in round one.
As far as the
well,
there was, Justice, that we had a little redaction argument first time we had a conversation.
Well, I was referring to specific language in the opinion. But for the sake of this argument, we are attempting to interpret and apply 1515A13, and it does allow for a request to be made and directs that the court must decide whether there are sufficient grounds. And it says according to applicable constitutional, statutory, and common law, and then ultimately use the least restrictive means to achieve the purposes of the access rule. So my question that doesn't say just look at the statutory grounds. So what is your thought about what that language requires the court to do?
And we would say, because the statute is clear, that if you look at the statutory grounds, and so that's where it's going to take us back to the 23A35 4.1, and that's where, if we look at, let's round one in this case, this court said, well, yes, you look at statutory common law, however, the statute has spoken and it's clear that is a presumptively open document. And so the request that counsel now makes, or the appellant makes in this case, under 13, they're asking for a special sneak peek at a presumptively open document. Everybody should have that document. That document should be out there. This sneak peek that they want should be shut down without equivocation. And said, no, you don't get a sneak peek. You don't get a look at it before somebody else.
Do you join the state's request for specific standards from the court, or do you see them as unnecessary? One redaction, Mr. Swedlin was advocating that we adopt some factors for redaction. Does your client think that's necessary, or do you think it's just open access?
No, I think this is 100% open access. As far as the redaction is clear, judge knows what he's got to do as far as redaction under 15-15A8, what he needs to take out. Our response would be, if there's a request to change or put in some redaction procedure, that's for the legislature. I think last time we had a similar argument that, you know, the response is take it upstairs. We're not asking this court to craft some redaction statute or interpret it. Say, we're asking this court to say, you know what, folks? Judge Power told you the first time. We told you last time. Judge Power told you again. This is over. Statute's clear. That is an open document, public access. Now, if there's something in there that they don't want, then they can follow the statute. But Justice Devaney asked a question earlier about...
Your time is up, Mr. Beck. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
Mr. Arneson, you can proceed with your argument on behalf of the Argus Leader.
Thank you. I'm John Arneson, representing Argus Leader Media. Trying to finish up. My 15 minutes of fame is now down to 6, but I'll do my best. I would like to focus, if I could, on what this court said the first time this case was appealed. And I think it answers a lot of questions. Excuse me. In paragraph 16, this court unanimously, with the exception of Justice Gilbertson, said when the language of a statute is clear, certain, and unambiguous, the court's only function is to declare the meaning of the statute, which is clearly expressed, and they're referring, of course, to 4.1. The plain language of 23A.35.4.1 in paragraph 18 provides an unmistakable expression of legislative intent. A court may seal the contents of an affidavit, as this court just noted, upon a showing of reasonable cause, but only until the investigation is terminated or an indictment or information is filed. Paragraph 21, with respect to the interpretation of 1515A.13, this court basically undermines Sanford's contention regarding the parameters of judicial discretion to restrict access by emphasizing that courts do not have carte blanche and they are bound by the applicable constitutional, statutory, and common law. As Judge Power said, and as this court agreed, that statute, 23A.35.4.1, is a legislative intent that affidavits in support of search warrants are public records when certain events happen. Those events have happened. This whole process of redaction has gotten us sidetracked from what that statute says. And then this court also said, giving deference to the personal identifiers, which we've talked about redacting as general automatic redaction, that's where it ended. We perceive no tension between our rules allowing for that limited redaction of this personal identifying information and 4.1's requirement to allow access to the broader contents of a search warrant. The court finally made the observation that perhaps Sanford's counsel had not bothered to even offer an interpretation of 23A.35.4.1, the first go-around, because of its intransigence, meaning it says what it says. It doesn't have all these options and machinations to expand. It says these search warrant affidavits are public record because the investigation from the state of South Dakota is over. Now, that's not to say we don't know what the feds are doing, but as far as South Dakota is concerned, that's all we're concerned about in this case. It's a state law. Again, the legislature said that is their intent, and this court has not said that the court supersedes that. In fact, the court went on to say, in the end, the application of 4.1 is unavoidable, and it means what it says. There is no constitutional collision between the branches of government, and there is no tension between our court rules and a plain, unambiguous statute. Finally, last paragraph, it said, notwithstanding the skilled advocacy on behalf of the parties, I like that part, the question we confront is not a close one. It wasn't close then, it's less close now. 23A.35.4.1 says these are public records now. The rest of this is superfluous. I hate to say it, but we shouldn't be here.
Well, you'd still admit, though, that there is a redaction to be done by at least the trial court. I mean, you're just not going to have them opened up this afternoon, I assume, if you get your way.
I would agree to the point of the personal identifiers that this court has suggested is the limit. That the otherwise go to the legislature. But this court acknowledged that there is not a collision between the branches and that their rules are in place and that the rules stop your rules, the court rules, the UJS rules stop at the point of allowing these personal identifiers to be redacted as a matter of course. Beyond that, no. That's what was said, and it would be presumptuous of me to try to tell you what you've already written, but that's what was said, and I guess I'll take that chance. I think that applies here. I have nothing more to say. If you have questions, I'd be free to freely entertain them.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson.
Thank you.
Ms. Hagee, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Your Honor, the affidavits are public record. We aren't disputing that. What you just heard from the Argus Leader and ProPublica, we don't disagree with in the sense that they are public records. The 4.1 triggering event has occurred here. However, you still must look to the broader contents of that affidavit for confidential information that must be disclosed pursuant to the Constitution, pursuant to state laws and other federal laws as well. And ProPublica just acknowledged that that can actually be broader than 1515A8. Like the circuit court here included additional information outside that scope. To read it otherwise would require this court and the courts to unseal these affidavits that are violative of the Constitution, to the effect that any Marcy's Law rights are affected, where a victim has the right to prohibit the release of information.
Well, you didn't make that Marcy's Law argument in your briefs, did you, to this court?
I believe I referenced its implication and to the extent where 4.1 is interpreted like that, it would be unconstitutional because you have a conflict with what the Constitution is allowing right there. You have other federal laws, substance use disorder records under 42 U.S.C. Section 290DD-2, subsection C, where certain substance use records must remain confidential. HIPAA requirements, intercepted communications under 18 U.S.C. 2518. All of these are instances where there may be, and I don't know because we haven't had the opportunity to look, maybe that information is in there. We don't know at this point without seeing the affidavit itself. We're in the best position, as it's our own information, to make those arguments and protect our own information. Now, the court has indicated whether the circuit court abused its discretion. And I would ask this court to consider whether 1515A13 carries with it that implicit right to inspect the document itself under the de novo standard of review. You're looking at the interpretation and application of that statute and any rights that are encompassed by that statute. To the extent that this court were to look at it and find that no, there isn't in fact a requirement to allow the individual to look at the document first before asking for the information to be redacted, only then would it be an abuse of discretion. But again, here the circuit court abused its discretion in providing the press interested party status and really focusing on that as an issue in all of its reasons for denying my client's request to the affidavits itself. Regardless of who you are, anyone that is subject to a criminal investigation that has since been cleared should have the opportunity to review the information that has been compiled about you before it's released to the general public to make sure that there's no confidential information that you have a right to request. Under the circuit court's ruling here, You have to sit back and watch others redact information that they think is necessary to protect your own interests. My client, under 1515A13, has the right to ask the court to redact confidential information within that affidavit. To give that right any effect, we must see the document itself first. If there's no further questions, I will have a seat.
Thank you.
Thank you.